Random House Audio presents The Orphan Master's Son, a novel by Adam Johnson. Read for you by Tim Kang with Josiah D. Lee and James Kyson Lee.
Citizens, gather around your loudspeakers, for we bring important updates. In your kitchens, in your offices, on your factory floors, wherever your loudspeaker is located, turn up the volume. In local news, our dear leader Kim Jong-il was seen offering on-the-spot guidance to the engineers deepening the Taedong River channel. While the dear leader lectured to the dredge operators, many doves were seen to spontaneously flock above him, hovering to provide our reverend general some much-needed shade on a hot day. Also to report is a request from Pyongyang's Minister of Public Safety, who asks that while pigeon snaring season is in full swing, tripwires and snatched loops be placed out of the reach of our youngest comrades. And don't forget, citizens, the ban on stargazing is still in effect. Later in the broadcast, we will reveal the winning recipe for this month's cooking contest. Hundreds of recipes were entered, but only one can be declared the best way to prepare pumpkin rind soup. But first comes grave news from the East Sea, where American aggressors flirt with acts of all-out war after stopping and looting a North Korean fishing vessel. Once again, the Yankees have violated Korean waters to steal the precious contents of a sovereign ship, all the while accusing us of everything from banditry to kidnapping to cruelty to sharks. First off, it is the Americans and their puppets who are the pirates of the sea. Secondly, did an American woman not recently roll around the entire world to defect to our great nation, a worker's paradise where citizens want for nothing? That alone should be proof enough that these persistent accusations of kidnapping are ludicrous. But cruelty to sharks? This charge must be addressed. Known as the fisherman's friend, the shark has an ancient camaraderie with the Korean people. In the year 1592, the sharks not offer fish from their own mouths to help sustain Admiral Yi's sailors during the siege of Okpo Harbor? Have sharks not developed cancer-preventing powers in order to help their human friends live longer and healthier? Does our own Commander Ga, winner of the Golden Belt, not have a soothing bowl of shark fin soup before each triumphant taekwondo match? And citizens, did you not see with your own eyes a movie entitled A True Daughter of the Country, right here in Pyongyang's own Moranbong Theater? Then certainly you remember the scene in which our national actress Sun Moon capsized in Incheon Bay while trying to prevent the American sneak attack. It was a scary moment for all of us as the sharks began to circle her, helpless amid the waves. But did the sharks not recognize Sun Moon's Korean modesty? Did they not smell the hot blood of her patriotism and lift her upon their fins to carry her safely to shore, where she could join the raging battle to repel the imperialist invaders? By these deeds alone, citizens, you must know that the rumors swirling around Pyongyang that Commander Ga and Sun Moon are anything less than utterly in love are baseless lies. Baseless as the boarding of our innocent fishing vessels by foreign powers. Baseless as the outlandish allegations of kidnapping leveled at us by the Japanese. Do the Japanese think we forget it is they who once enslaved our husbands and made comfort women of our wives? Baseless to think that any woman loves her husband more than Sun Moon. Did the citizens not behold how Sun Moon bestowed the golden belt upon her new husband, her cheeks flushed with modesty and love? Were you not assembled in Kim Il-sung Square to witness it firsthand? What are you going to believe, citizens? Rumors and lies, or your very own eyes? But let us return to the rest of today's programming, which includes a rebroadcast of Kim Il-sung's glorious speech of April 15th, Juche 71, and a public service announcement from the Minister of Procurement, Comrade Byuk, on the topic of prolonging the life of compact fluorescent light bulbs. But first, citizens, a treat. It is our pleasure to announce that Pyongyang has a new opera singer. The dear leader has dubbed her the lovely visitor. And here she is to sing for your patriotic pleasure the arias from Sea of Blood. So return to your industrial lathes and vinylon looms, citizens, and double your output quotas as you listen to this lovely visitor sing the story of the greatest nation in the world, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
Part 1. The Biography of Jun Do. Jun Do's mother was a singer. That was all Jun Do's father, the orphan master, would say about her. The orphan master kept a photograph of a woman in his small room at Long Tomorrow's. She was quite lovely. Eyes large and sideways looking, lips pursed with an unspoken word. Since beautiful women in the provinces get shipped to Pyongyang, that's certainly what had happened to his mother. The real proof of this was the orphan master himself. At night, he'd drink, and from the barracks, the orphans would hear him weeping and lamenting, striking half-heard bargains with the woman in the photograph. Only Jun Do was allowed to comfort him, to finally take the bottle from his hands. As the oldest boy at Long Tomorrow's, Jun Do had responsibilities, portioning the food, assigning bunks, renaming the new boys from the list of the 114 Grand Martyrs of the Revolution. Even so, the orphan master was serious about showing no favoritism to his son, the only boy at Long Tomorrow's who wasn't an orphan. When the rabbit warren was dirty, it was Jun Do who spent the night locked in it. When boys wet their bunks, it was Jun Do who chipped the frozen piss off the floor. Jun Do didn't brag to the other boys that he was the son of the orphan master, rather than some kid dropped off by parents on their way to a 927 camp. If someone wanted to figure it out, it was pretty obvious. Jun Do had been there before all of them, and the reason he'd never been adopted was because his father would never let someone take his only son. And it made sense that after his mother was stolen to Pyongyang, his father had applied for the one position that would allow him to both earn a living and watch over his son. The surest evidence that the woman in the photo was Jun Do's mother was the unrelenting way the orphan master singled him out for punishment. It could only mean that in Jun Do's face, the orphan master saw the woman in the picture, a daily reminder of the eternal hurt he felt from losing her. Only a father in that kind of pain could take a boy's shoes in winter. Only a true father, flesh and bone, could burn a son with the smoking end of a coal shovel. Occasionally, a factory would adopt a group of kids, and in the spring, men with Chinese accents would come to make their picks. Other than that, anyone who could feed the boys and provide a bottle for the orphan master could have them for the day. In summer, they filled sandbags, and in winter, they used metal bars to break sheets of ice from the docks. On the machining floors, for bowls of cold japchae, they would shovel the coils of oily metal that sprayed from the industrial lathes. The rail yard fed them best, though, spicy yukgaejang. One time, shoveling out boxcars, they swept up a powder that looked like salt. It wasn't until they started sweating that they turned red, their hands and faces, their teeth. The train had been filled with chemicals for the paint factory. For weeks, they were red. And then in the year, Juche 85, the floods came. 3 weeks of rain, yet the loudspeakers said nothing of terraces collapsing, earth dams giving, villages cascading into one another. The army was busy trying to save the Sung Lee 58 factory from the rising water, so the Long Tomorrow's boys were given ropes and long-handled gaffs to try to snare people from the Chongjin River before they were washed into the harbor. The water was a roil of timber, petroleum tanks, and latrine barrels. A tractor tire turned in the water, a Soviet refrigerator. They heard the deep booms of boxcars tumbling along the river bottom. The canopy of a troop carrier spun past, a screaming family clinging to it. Then a young woman rose from the water, mouth wide but silent, and the orphan called Bosung gaffed her arm. Right away he was jerked into the current. Bosung had come to the orphanage a frail boy. and when they discovered he had no hearing, Jundo gave him the name Un Bosong, after the 37th martyr of the revolution, who'd famously put mud in his ears so he couldn't hear the bullets as he charged the Japanese. Still, the boy shouted, Bosong! Bosong! As they ran the riverbanks, racing beside the patch of river where Bosong should have been. They ran past the outfall pipes of the Unification Steelworks and along the muddy berms of the Yongsong's leech ponds, but Bosong was never seen again. The boys stopped at the harbor, its dark waters ropey with corpses, thousands of them in the throes of the waves, looking like curds of sticky millet that start to flop and toss when the pan heats. Though they didn't know it, this was the beginning of the famine. First went the power, then the train service. When the shockwork whistle stopped blowing, Jundo knew it was bad. One day the fishing fleet went out and didn't come back. With winter came Blackfinger, and the old people went to sleep. These were just the first months, long before the bark eaters. The loudspeakers called the famine an arduous march, but that voice was piped in from Pyongyang. Jundo had never heard anyone in Chongjin call it that. What was happening to them didn't need a name. It was everything. Every fingernail you chewed and swallowed, every lift of an eyelid, every trip to the latrine where you tried to shit out wads of bald sawdust. When all hope was gone, the orphan master burned the bunks, the boys sleeping around a pot stove that glowed on their last night. In the morning, he flagged down a Soviet seer, the military truck they called the Crow because of its black canvas canopy on the back. There were only a dozen boys left, a perfect fit in the back of the Crow. All orphans are destined for the army eventually, but this was how Jundo, at 14, became a tunnel soldier, trained in the art of zero light combat. And that's where Officer Saw found him, 8 years later. The old man actually came underground to get a look at Jundo, who'd spent an overnighter with his team inside a tunnel that went 10 kilometers under the DMZ, almost to the suburbs of Seoul. When exiting a tunnel, they'd always walk out backward to let their eyes adjust, and he almost ran into Officer Saw, whose shoulders and big rib cage spoke of a person who'd come of age in the good times, before the Cholima campaigns.
Are you Buck Jundo?
He asked. When Jundo turned, a circle of light glowed behind the man's close-cropped white hair. The skin on his face was darker than his scalp or jaw, making it look like the man had just shaved off a beard and thick, wild hair.
That's me, Jundo said. That's a martyr's name, Officer Saw said. Is this an orphan detail?
Jundo nodded his head.
It is, he said.
But I'm not an orphan.
Officer Saw's eyes fell upon the red Taekwondo badge on Jundo's chest.
Fair enough,
Officer Saw said, and tossed him a sack. In it were blue jeans, a yellow shirt with a polo pony, and shoes called Nikes that Jundo recognized from long ago, when the orphanage was used to welcome ferry loads of Koreans who had been lured back from Japan with promises of party jobs and apartments in Pyongyang. The orphans would wave welcome banners and sing party songs so that the Japanese Koreans would descend the gangway, despite the horrible state of Chongjin and the crows that were waiting to transport them all to Kwanlisaw labor camps. It was like yesterday, watching those perfect boys with their new sneakers finally coming home. Jundo held up the yellow shirt.
What am I supposed to do with this?
He asked.
It's your new uniform, Officer Saw said. You don't get seasick, do you?
He didn't. They took a train to the eastern port of Cholhuang, where Officer Saw commandeered a fishing boat. The crew so frightened of their military guests that they wore their Kim Il-sung pins all the way across the sea to the coast of Japan. Upon the water, Jundo saw small fish with wings and late morning fog so thick it took the words from your mouth. There were no loudspeakers blaring all day, and all the fishermen had portraits of their wives tattooed on their chests. The sea was spontaneous in a way he'd never seen before. It kept your body uncertain as to how you'd lean next, and yet you could become comfortable with that. The wind and the rigging seemed in communication with the waves shouldering the hull. And lying atop the wheelhouse under the stars at night, it seemed to Jundo that this was a place a man could close his eyes and exhale. Officer Saw had also brought along a man named Gil as their translator. Gil read Japanese novels on the deck and listened to headphones attached to a small cassette player. Only once did Jundo try to speak to Gil, approaching him to ask what he was listening to. But before Jundo could open his mouth, Gil stopped the player and said the word, "Opera!" They were going to get someone on a beach, and bring that someone home with them. That's all Officer Saw would say about their trip. On the second day, darkness falling, they could see the distant lights of a town, but the captain would take the boat no closer. "This is Japan," he said. "I don't have charts for these waters." "I'll tell you how close we get," Officer Saw said to the captain, and with a fisherman sounding for the bottom, they made for the shore. Jundo got dressed, cinching the belt to keep the stiff jeans on.
"Are these the clothes of the last guy you kidnapped?"
Jundo asked.
Officer Saw said, "I haven't kidnapped anyone in years."
Jundo felt his face muscles tighten, a sense of dread running through him.
"Relax," Officer Saw said. "I've done this 100 times.
"Seriously?"
"Well, 27 times.
Officer Saw had brought a little skiff along, and when they were close to the shore, he directed the fishermen to lower it. To the west, the sun was setting over North Korea, and it was cooling now, the wind shifting direction. The skiff was tiny, Jundo thought. Barely big enough for one person, let alone three, and a struggling kidnap victim. With a pair of binoculars and a thermos, Officer Saw climbed down into the skiff. Gil followed. When Jundo took his place next to Gil, black water lapped over the sides, and right away his shoes soaked through. He debated, revealing that he couldn't swim. Gil kept trying to get Jundo to repeat phrases in Japanese. "Good evening."
"Konbanwa."
"Excuse me, I am lost."
"Chotto sumimasen, michi ni mayoimashita."
"Can you help me find my cat?"
"Watashi no neko ga maigo ni narimashita."
Officer Saw pointed their nose toward shore. The old man pushing the outboard motor, a tired Soviet Vipresna, way too hard. Turning north and running with the coast, the boat would lean shoreward as a swell lifted, then rock back toward open water as the wave set it down again. Gil took the binoculars, but instead of training them on the beach, he studied the tall buildings, the way the downtown neon came to life.
"I tell you," Gil said, "there was no arduous march in this place."
Jundo and Officer Saw exchanged a look. Officer Saw said to Gil,
"Tell him what 'how are you' was again."
"Ogenki desu ka?" Gil said.
"Ogenki desu ka?"
Jundo repeated.
"Ogenki desu ka?" "Say it like, 'How are you, my fellow citizen?' Ogenki desu ka?"
Officer Saw said.
"Not like, 'How are you? I'm about to pluck you off this fucking beach.'"
Jundo asked, "Is that what you call it, plucking?"
"A long time ago, that's what we called it."
He put on a fake smile.
"Just say it nice."
Jundo said,
"Why not send Gil? He's the one who speaks Japanese."
Officer Saw returned his eyes to the water.
"You know why you're here?"
Gil asked,
"Why is he here?"
Officer Saw said,
"Because he fights in the dark."
Gil turned to Jundo.
"You mean that's what you do? That's your career?"
he asked.
"I lead an incursion team," Jundo said. "Mostly we run in the dark,
But yeah, there's fighting too. Gil said, I thought my job was fucked up.
What was your job? Jundo asked.
Before I went to language school?
Gil asked.
Landmines. What? Like defusing them?
I wish, Gil said. They closed within a couple hundred meters of shore, then trolled along the beaches of Kagoshima Prefecture. The more the light faded, the more intricately Jundo could see it reflected in the architecture of each wave that rolled them. Gil lifted his hand.
There, he said. There's somebody on the beach. A woman.
Officer Saw backed off the throttle and took the field glasses. He held them steady and fine-tuned them, his bushy white eyebrows lifting and falling as he focused.
No,
he said, handing the binoculars back to Gil.
Look closer. It's two women. They're walking together.
Jundo said, I thought you were looking for a guy.
It doesn't matter, the old man said, as long as the person's alone.
What? We're supposed to grab just anybody? Officer Saw didn't answer. For a while, there was nothing but the sound of the Vipresna. Then Officer Saw said,
In my time, we had a whole division, a budget. I'm talking about a speedboat, a tranquilizing gun. We'd surveil, infiltrate, cherry pick. We didn't pluck family types, and we never took children. I retired with a perfect record. Now look at me. I must be the only one left. I'll bet I'm the only one they could find who remembers this business.
Gil fixed on something on the beach. He wiped the lenses of the binoculars, but really it was too dark to see anything. He handed them to Jundo.
What do you make out?
He asked. When Jundo lifted the binoculars, he could barely discern a male figure moving along the beach, near the water. He was just a lighter blur against a darker blur, really. Then some motion caught Jundo's eye. An animal was racing down the beach toward the man. A dog, it must have been, but it was big, the size of a wolf. The man did something, and the dog ran away. Jundo turned to Officer Saw.
There's a man. He's got a dog with him.
Officer Saw sat up and put a hand on the outboard engine.
Is he alone?
Jundo nodded.
Is the dog an Akita?
Jundo didn't know his breeds. Once a week, the orphans had cleaned out a local dog farm. Dogs were filthy animals that would lunge for you at any opportunity. You could see where they'd attack the posts of their pens, chewing through the wood with their fangs. That's all Jundo needed to know about dogs. Officer Saw said,
As long as the thing wags its tail, that's all you got to worry about.
Gil said,
The Japanese train their dogs to do little tricks. Say to the dog, Nice doggy, sit. Yoshi yoshi. Osuwari kawaii desu ne.
Jundo said,
Will you shut up with the Japanese?
Jundo wanted to ask if there was a plan, but Officer Saw simply turned them toward the shore. Back in Panmunjom, Jundo was the leader of his tunnel squad, so he had a liquor ration and a weekly credit for one of the women. In 3 days, he had the quarterfinals of the KPA Taekwondo tournament. Jundo's squad swept every tunnel under the DMZ once a month, and they worked without lights, which meant jogging for kilometers in complete darkness, using their red lights only when they reached a tunnel's end and needed to inspect its seals and tripwires. They worked as if they might encounter the South Koreans at any point, and except for the rainy season, when the tunnels were too muddy to use, they trained daily in zero light hand-to-hand. It was said that the ROK soldiers had infrared and American night vision goggles. The only weapon Jundo's boys had was the dark. When the waves got rough and he felt panicky, Jundo turned to Gil.
So what's this job that's worse than disarming landmines?
Mapping them. Gil said.
What, with a sweeper?
Metal detectors don't work, Gil said.
The Americans use plastic mines now. We made maps of where they probably were, using psychology and terrain. When a path forces a step, or tree roots direct your feet, that's where we assume a mine and mark it down. We'd spend all night in a minefield, risking our lives with every step. And for what? Come morning, the mines were still there. The enemy was still there. Jundo knew who got the worst jobs. Tunnel recon. 12-man submarines. Mines. Biochem. And he suddenly saw Gil differently. "So you're an orphan," he said. Gil looked shocked. "Not at all. Are you?" "No," Jundo said. "Not me." Jundo's own unit was made up of orphans, though in Jundo's case it was a mistake. The address on his KPA card had been Long Tomorrow's, and that's what had condemned him. It was a glitch no one in North Korea seemed capable of fixing, and now this was his fate. He'd spent his life with orphans. He understood their special plight, so he didn't hate them like most people did. He just wasn't one of them. "And you're a translator now?" Jundo asked him. "You work the minefields long enough," Gil said, "and they reward you. They send you someplace cushy, like language school." Officer Saw laughed a bitter little laugh. The white foam of the breakers was sweeping into the boat now. "The shitty thing is," Gil said, "when I'm walking down the street, I'll think that's where I'd put a landmine. Or I'll find myself not stepping on certain places, like door thresholds or in front of a urinal. I can't even go to a park anymore." "A park?" Jundo asked. He'd never seen a park.
"Enough," Officer Saw said. "It's time to get that language school a new Japanese teacher."
He throttled back and the surf grew loud, the skiff turning sideways in the waves. They could see the outline of a man on the beach watching them, but they were helpless now, just 20 meters from shore. When Jundo felt the boat start to go over, he leaped out to steady it, and though it was only waist deep, he went down hard in the waves. The tide rolled him along the sandy bottom before he came up, coughing. The man on the beach didn't say anything. It was almost dark as Jundo waded ashore. Jundo took a deep breath, then wiped the water from his hair.
"Konbanwa,"
he said to the stranger.
"Odenki kesta. Ogenki deska,"
Gil called from the boat.
"Deska,"
Jundo repeated. The dog came running up with a yellow ball. For a moment, the man didn't move. Then he took a step backward.
"Get him!"
Officer Saw shouted. The man bolted, and Jundo gave chase in wet jeans, his shoes caked with sand. The dog was big and white, bounding with excitement. The Japanese man ran straight down the beach, nearly invisible but for the dog moving from one side of him to the other. Jundo ran for all he was worth. He focused only on the heartbeat-like thumps of feet padding ahead in the sand. Then he closed his eyes. In the tunnels, Jundo had developed a sense of people he couldn't see. If they were out there, he could feel it, and if he could get within range, he could home in on them. His father, the orphan master, had always given him a sense that his mother was dead, but that wasn't true. She was alive and well, just out of range. And while he'd never heard news of what happened to the orphan master, Jundo could feel that his father was no longer in this world. The key to fighting in the dark was no different. You had to perceive your opponent, sense him, and never use your imagination. The darkness inside your head is something your imagination fills with stories that have nothing to do with the real darkness around you. From ahead came the body thud of someone falling in the dark, a sound Jundo had heard 1,000 times. Jundo pulled up where the man was righting himself. His face was ghostly with a dusting of sand. They were huffing and puffing, their joined breath white in the dark. The truth was that Jundo never did that well in tournaments. When you fought in the dark, a jab only told your opponent where you were. In the dark, you had to punch as if you were punching through people.
Maximum extension is what mattered. Haymaker punches and great, whirling roundhouse kicks that took out whole swaths of space and were meant to cut people down. In a tournament, though, opponents could see moves like that coming from a mile away. They simply stepped aside. But a man on a beach at night, standing on the balls of his feet, Jundo executed a spinning back kick to the head, and the stranger went down. The dog was filled with energy, excitement perhaps, or frustration. It pawed at the sand near the unconscious man, then dropped its ball. Jundo wanted to throw the ball, but he didn't dare get near those teeth. Its tail, Jundo suddenly realized, wasn't wagging. Jundo saw a glint in the dark. The man's glasses, it turned out. He put them on, and the fuzzy glow above the dunes turned into crisp points of light in people's windows. Instead of huge housing blocks, the Japanese lived in smaller, individual-sized barracks. Jundo pocketed the glasses, then took up the man's ankles and began pulling from behind. The dog was growling and giving short, aggressive barks. When Jundo looked over his shoulder, the dog was growling in the man's face and using its paws to scratch his cheeks and forehead. Jundo lowered his head and pulled. The first day in a tunnel is no problem. But when you wake on the second day, from the darkness of a dream into true darkness, that's when your eyes must open. If you keep your eyes closed, your mind will show you all kinds of crazy movies, like a dog attacking you from behind. But with your eyes open, all you had to face was the nothingness of what you were really doing. When finally Jundo found the boat in the dark, he let the dead weight fall into its aluminum crossmembers. The man opened his eyes once and rolled them around, but there was no comprehension.
"What did you do to his face?" Gil asked.
"Where were you?"
Jundo asked.
"That guy was heavy."
"I'm just the translator," Gil said.
Officer Saw clapped Jundo on the back.
"Not bad for an orphan,"
he said. Jundo wheeled on him.
"I'm not a fucking orphan," he said. "And who the hell are you saying you've done this 100 times? We come out here with no plan, just me running someone down? You didn't even get out of the boat."
"I had to see what you were made of,"
Officer Saw said.
"Next time, we'll use our brains."
"There won't be any next time,"
Jundo said. Gil and Jundo spun the boat to face the waves. They got battered while Officer Saw pull-started the motor. When the four of them were in and headed toward open water, Officer Saw said,
"Look, it gets easier. Just don't think about it. I was full of shit when I said I'd kidnapped 27 people. I never kept count. As they come, just forget about them, one after another. Catch somebody with your hands, then let them go with your mind. Do the opposite of keeping count."
Even over the outboard, they could hear that dog on the beach. No matter how far out they got, its baying carried over the water. And Jundo knew he'd hear that dog forever. They stayed at a Songun base, not far from the port of Kinje. It was surrounded by the earthen bunkers of surface-to-air missiles, and when the sun set, they could see the white rails of launchers glowing in the moonlight. Because they'd been to Japan now, they had to bunk apart from the regular KPA soldiers. The three were housed in the infirmary, a small room with 6 cots. The only sign it was an infirmary was a lone cabinet filled with blood-taking instruments and an old Chinese refrigerator with a red cross on its door. They'd locked the Japanese man in one of the hot boxes in the drill yard, and Gil was out there now practicing his Japanese through the slop hole in the door. Jundo and Officer Saw leaned against the infirmary's window frame, sharing a cigarette as they watched Gil, out there, sitting in the dirt, polishing his idioms with a man he'd helped kidnap. Officer Saw shook his head, like now he'd seen it all. There was one patient in the infirmary, a small soldier of about 16, bones knit from the famine. He lay on a cot, teeth chattering. Their cigarette smoke was giving him coughing fits. They moved his cot as far away as possible in the small room, but still he wouldn't shut up. There was no doctor. The infirmary was just a place where sick soldiers were housed until it was clear they wouldn't recover. If the young soldier hadn't improved by morning, the MPs would hook up a bloodline and drain 4 units from him. Jundo had seen it before, and as far as he could tell, it was the best way to go. It only took a couple of minutes. First they got sleepy, then a little dreamy looking, and if there was a last little panic at the end, it didn't matter because they couldn't talk anymore. And finally, before lights out, they looked pleasantly confused, like a cricket with its feelers pulled off. The camp generator shut down. Slowly the lights dimmed, the fridge went quiet. Officer Saw and Jundo took to their cots. There was a Japanese man. He took his dog for a walk. And then he was nowhere. For the people who knew him, he'd forever be nowhere. That's how Jundo had thought of boys selected by the men with Chinese accents. They were here, and then they were nowhere, taken like Bosong to parts unknown. That's how he'd thought of most people, appearing in your life like foundlings on the doorstep, only to be swept away later as if by flood. But Bosong hadn't gone nowhere, whether he sank down to the wool fields or bloated and took the tide north to Vladivostok, he went somewhere. The Japanese man wasn't nowhere either. He was in the hot box, right out there in the drill grounds. And Jundo's mother, it now struck him. She was somewhere, at this very moment, in a certain apartment in the capital, perhaps, looking in a mirror, brushing her hair before bed. For the first time in years, Jundo closed his eyes and let himself recall her face. It was dangerous to dream up people like that. If you did, they'd soon be in the tunnel with you. That had happened many times when he remembered boys from long tomorrows. One slip, and a boy was suddenly following you in the dark. He was saying things to you, asking why you weren't the one who succumbed to the cold, why you weren't the one who fell in the paint vat. And you'd get the feeling that at any moment, the toes of a front kick would cross your face. But there she was, his mother. Lying there, listening to the shivering of the soldier, her voice came to him. Arirang. She sang, her voice achy at the edge of a whisper, coming from an unknown somewhere. Even those fucking orphans knew where their parents were. Late in the night, Gil stumbled in. He opened the fridge, which was forbidden, and placed something inside. Then he flopped onto his cot. Gil slept with his arms and legs sprawled off the edges, and Jundo could tell that as a child, Gil must have had a bed of his very own. In a moment, he was out. Jundo and Officer Saw stood in the dark and went to the fridge. When Officer Saw pulled its handle, it exhaled a faint, cool breath. In the back, behind stacks of square blood bags, Officer Saw fished out a half-full bottle of soju. They closed the door quickly because the blood was bound for Pyongyang, and if it spoiled, there'd be hell to pay. They took the bottle to the window. Far in the distance, dogs were barking in their warrens. On the horizon, above the SAM bunkers, there was a glow in the sky, moonlight reflecting off the ocean. Behind them, Gil began gassing in his sleep. Officer Saw drank.
I don't think old Giz used to a diet of millet cakes and sorghum soup.
Who the hell is he? Jundo asked.
Forget about him, Officer Saw said. I don't know why Pyongyang started this business up again after all these years, but hopefully we'll be rid of him in a week. One mission, and if everything goes right, we'll never see that guy again.
Jundo took a drink, his stomach clutching at the fruit, the alcohol.
What's the mission? He asked.
First, another practice run, Officer Saw said. Then we're going after a special someone. The Tokyo Opera spends its summers in Niigata.
There's a soprano. Her name is Rumina.
The next drink of soju went down smooth. Opera? Jundo asked. Officer Sa shrugged.
Some big shot in Pyongyang probably heard a bootleg and had to have her.
Gil said he survived a landmine tour, Jundo said. For that, they sent him to language school.
Is it true? Does it work like that? Do you get rewarded?
We're stuck with Gil, okay? But you don't listen to him. You listen to me.
Jundo was quiet.
Why? You got your heart set on something?
Officer Sa asked.
You even know what you'd want as a reward?
Jundo shook his head.
Then don't worry about it.
Officer Sa walked to the corner and leaned over the latrine bucket. He braced himself against the wall and strained for a long time. Nothing happened.
I pulled off a miracle or two in my day, he said. I got rewarded. Now look at me.
He shook his head.
The reward you want is this. Don't become me.
Jundo stared out the window at the hot box. What's going to happen to him?
The dog man?
Officer Sa asked.
There are probably a couple of pubyok on the train from Pyongyang right now to get him.
Yeah, but what's going to happen to him? Officer Sa tried one last push to get some urine out.
Don't ask stupid questions,
he said through his teeth. Jundo thought of his mother on a train to Pyongyang. For your reward, could you ask for a person?
What? A woman?
Officer Sa shook his umgyeong in frustration.
Yeah, you could ask for that.
He came back and drank the rest of the bottle, saving only a swish in the bottom. This he poured, a dribble at a time, over the dying soldier's lips. Officer Sa clapped him goodbye on the chest. Then he stuffed the empty bottle in the crook of the boy's sweat-soaked arm. They commandeered a new fishing boat, made another crossing. Over the Tsushima Basin, they could hear the powerful clicks, like punches to the chest, of sperm whales hunting below. And nearing the island of Togo, granite spires rose sudden from the sea. White up top from bird guano, and orange below from great gatherings of starfish. Jundo stared up toward the island's north promontory, volcanic black, limbed in dwarf spruce. This was a world wrought for its own sake, without message or point, a landscape that would make no testimony for one great leader over another. There was a famous resort on this island, and Officer Sa thought they could catch a tourist alone on the beach. But when they reached the lee of the island, there was an empty boat on the water, a black Avon inflatable, six-man, with a 50-horse Honda outboard. They took the skiff over to investigate. The Avon was abandoned, not a soul upon the waters. They climbed aboard, and Officer Sa started the Honda engine. He shut it down. He pulled the gas can out of the skiff, and together they rolled it in the water. It filled quickly, going down ass first with the weight of the Vipresna.
Now we're a proper team,
Officer Sa said as they admired their new boat. That's when the diver surfaced. Lifting his mask, the diver showed a look of uncertain wonder to discover three men in his boat. But he handed up a sack of abalone and took Gil's hand to help him aboard. The diver was larger than them, muscular in a wetsuit. Officer Sa spoke to Gil.
Tell him our boat was damaged, that it sank.
Gil spoke to the diver, who gestured wildly and laughed.
I know your boat sank,
Gil translated back.
It almost landed on my head.
Then the diver noticed the fishing vessel in the distance. He cocked his head at it. Gil clapped the diver on the back and said something to him. The diver stared hard into Gil's eyes and then panicked. Abalone divers, it turned out, carried a special kind of knife on their ankles, and Jundo was a long time in subduing him. Finally, Jundo took the diver's back and began to squeeze, the water ringing from his wetsuit as the scissors choke sank in. When the knife was flying, Gil had jumped overboard.
"What the fuck did you say to him?"
Jundo demanded.
"The truth,"
Gil said, treading water. Officer Saw had caught a pretty good gash in the forearm. He closed his eyes at the pain of it.
"More practice,"
is all he could say. They put the diver in the fishing boat's hold and continued to the mainland. That night, offshore from the town of Fukura, they put the Avon in the water. Next to Fukura's long fishing pier, a summer amusement park had set up with lanterns strung and old people singing karaoke on a public stage. Here, Jundo and Gil and Officer Saw hovered beyond the beach break, waiting for the neon piping on the roller coaster to go dark, for the monkeyish organ music of the midway to fall silent. Finally, a solitary figure stood at the end of the pier. When they saw the red of a cigarette, they knew it was a man. Officer Saw started the engine. They motored in on idle, the pier towering as they came astern it. Where its pilings entered the heavy surf, there was chaos, with some waves leaping straight up and others deflecting out perpendicular to shore.
"Use your Japanese," Officer Saw told Gil. "Tell him you lost your puppy or something. Get close, then, over the rail. It's a long fall, and the water's cold. When he comes up, he'll be fighting to get in the boat."
Gil stepped out when they reached the beach.
"I've got it," he said. "This one's mine."
"Oh, no," Officer Saw said. "You both go."
"Seriously," Gil said. "I think I can handle it."
"Out," Officer Saw said to Jundo. "And wear those damn glasses."
The two of them crossed the tide line and came to a small square. Here were benches and a little plaza, a shuttered tea stand. There seemed to be no statue, and they could not tell what the square glorified. The trees were full with plums. So ripe, the skins broke and juice ran in their hands. It seemed impossible, a thing not to be trusted. A grubby man was sleeping on a bench, and they marveled at it, a person sleeping any place he wished. Gil stared at all the townhouses around them. They looked traditional, with dark beams and ceramic roofs, but you could tell they were brand new.
"I want to open all these doors," he said. "Sit in their chairs, listen to their music."
Jundo stared at him.
"You know," Gil said, "just to see."
The tunnels always ended with a ladder leading up to a rabbit hole. Jundo's men would vie to be the ones to slip out and wander South Korea for a while. They'd come back with stories of machines that handed out money and people who picked up dog shit and put it in bags. Jundo never looked. He knew the televisions were huge and there was all the rice you could eat. Yet he wanted no part of it. He was scared that if he saw it with his own eyes, his entire life would mean nothing. Stealing turnips from an old man who'd gone blind from hunger? That would have been for nothing. Sending another boy instead of himself to clean vats at the paint factory? For nothing. Jundo threw away his half-eaten plum.
"I've had better," he said.
On the pier, they walked planking stained from years of bait fishing. Ahead, at the end, they could see a face lit from the blue glow of a mobile phone.
"Just get him over the rail," Jundo said.
Gil took a breath.
"Over the rail," he repeated.
There were empty bottles on the pier, cigarette butts. Jundo was walking calmly forward, and he could feel Gil trying to copy this beside him. From below came the throaty bubble of an outboard idling. The figure ahead stopped speaking on the phone.
"Tare?"
a voice called to them.
"Tare nano?"
"Don't answer,"
Jundo whispered.
"It's a woman's voice,"
Gil said.
"Don't answer,"
Jundo said.
The hood of a coat was pulled back to reveal a young woman's face.
I'm not made for this, Gil said. Stick to the plan.
Their footsteps seemed impossibly loud. It struck Jun Do that one day, men had come for his mother like this, that he was now one of those men. Then they were upon her. She was small under the coat. She opened her mouth as if to scream, and Jun Do saw she had fine metalwork all along her teeth. They gripped her arms and muscled her up on the rail.
Zenzen oyoge nai desu,
she said, and though Jun Do could speak no Japanese, he knew it was a raw, imploring confession, like, I'm a virgin. They threw her over the rail. She fell away, silent, not a word or even the snatching of a breath. Jun Do saw something flash in her eyes, though. It wasn't fear or the senselessness of it. He could tell she was thinking of her parents and how they'd never know what became of her. From below came a splash and the gunning of an outboard. Jun Do couldn't shake that look in her eyes. On the pier was her phone. He picked it up and put it to his ear. Gil tried to say something, but Jun Do silenced him.
Mayumi?
A woman's voice asked.
Mayumi?
Jun Do pushed some buttons to make it stop. When he leaned over the rail, the boat was rising and falling in the swells.
Where is she?
Jun Do asked. Officer Sa was staring into the water.
She went down, he said. What do you mean, she went down?
He lifted his hands.
She hit, and then she was gone.
Jun Do turned to Gil.
What did she say?
Gil said,
she said, I can't swim.
I can't swim?
Jun Do asked.
She said she couldn't swim and you didn't stop me? Throwing her over, that was the plan. You said stick to it.
Jun Do looked into the black water again, deep here at the end of the pier. She was down there, that big coat like a sail in the current, her body rolling along the sandy floor. The phone rang. It glowed blue and vibrated in Jun Do's hand. He and Gil stared at it. Gil took the phone and listened, eyes wide. Jun Do could tell, even from here, that it was a woman's voice, a mother's.
Throw it away,
Jun Do told him.
Just toss it.
Gil's eyes roamed as he listened. His hand was trembling. He nodded his head several times. When he said,
Hey!
Jun Do grabbed it. He jabbed his finger at the buttons. There, on its small screen, appeared a picture of a baby. He threw it into the sea. Jun Do went to the rail.
How could you not keep count?
He yelled, down to Officer Sa.
How could you not keep count?
That was the end of their practice. It was time to get the opera lady. Officer Sa was to cross the Sea of Japan on a fishing vessel, while Jun Do and Gil took the overnight ferry from Chongjin to Niigata. At midnight, with the singer in hand, they would meet Officer Sa on the beach. Simplicity, Officer Sa said, was the key to the plan. Jun Do and Gil took the afternoon train north to Chongjin. At the station, families were sleeping under cargo platforms, waiting for darkness so they could make the journey to Sinuiju, which was just a swim across the Tumen River from China. They made for the port of Chongjin on foot. Passing the reunification smelter, its great cranes rusted in place, the copper lines to its furnace long since pilfered for scrap. Apartment blocks stood empty, their ration outlet windows butcher papered. There was no laundry hanging to dry, no onion smoke in the air. All the trees had been cut during the famine, and now, years later, the saplings were uniform in size, trunks ankle thick, their clean stalks popping up in the oddest places. In rain barrels and storm drains, one tree bursting from an outhouse where a human skeleton had shit its indigestible seed. Long tomorrows, when they came to it, looked no bigger than the infirmary.
Jundo shouldn't have pointed it out because Gil insisted they go in. It was filled only with shadows. Everything had been stripped for fuel. Even the door frames had been burned. The roster of the 114 Grand Martyrs of the Revolution, painted on the wall, was the only thing left. Gil didn't believe that Jundo had named all the orphans.
"You really memorized all the martyrs?" he asked. "What about number 11?
"That's Hashin," Jundo said.
"When he was captured, he cut out his own tongue so the Japanese could get no information from him. There was a boy here who wouldn't speak. I gave him that name."
Gil ran his finger down the list.
"Here you are," he said. "Martyr number 76, Pak Jundo. What's that guy's story?"
Jundo touched the blackness on the floor where the stove had once been.
"Even though he killed many Japanese soldiers," he said, "the revolutionaries in Pak Jundo's unit didn't trust him because he was descended from an impure bloodline. To prove his loyalty, he hanged himself."
Gil stared at him.
"You gave yourself this name. Why?"
"He passed the ultimate loyalty test." The orphan master's room, it turned out, was no bigger than a pallet. And of the portrait of the tormenting woman, Jundo could find only a nail hole.
"Is this where you slept?" Gil asked. "In the orphan master's room?"
Jundo showed him the nail hole.
"Here's where the portrait of my mother hung."
Gil inspected it.
"There was a nail here, all right," he said. "Tell me, if you lived with your father, how come you have an orphan's name?"
"He couldn't give me his name," Jundo said, "or everyone would see the shame of how he was forced to raise his son, and he couldn't bear to give me another man's name, even a martyr's. I had to do it."
Gil's expression was blank.
"What about your mother?" he asked. "What was her name?"
They heard the horn of the Manyongbong 92 ferry in the distance. Jundo said,
"Like putting a name to my problems would solve anything."
That night, Jundo stood in the dark stern of the ship, looking down into the turbulence of its wake.
"Rumina," he kept thinking.
He didn't listen for her voice or let himself visualize her. He only wondered how she'd spend this last day if she knew he was coming. It was late morning when they entered Bandaijima port, the customs houses displaying their international flags. Large shipping vessels painted humanitarian blue were being loaded with rice at their moorings. Jundo and Gil had forged documents, and in polo shirts, jeans, and sneakers, they descended the gangway into downtown Niigata. It was a Sunday. Making their way to the auditorium, Jundo saw a passenger jet crossing the sky, a big plume behind it. He gawked, neck craned. Amazing. So amazing, he decided to feign normalcy at everything, like the colored lights controlling the traffic, or the way buses kneeled, oxen-like, to let old people board. Of course the parking meters could talk, and the doors of businesses opened as they passed. Of course there was no water barrel in the bathroom, no ladle. The matinee was a medley of works the opera troupe would stage over the coming season, so all the singers took turns offering brief arias. Gil seemed to know the songs, humming along with them. Rumina, small, broad-shouldered, mounted the stage in a dress the color of graphite. Her eyes were dark under sharp bangs. Jundo could tell she'd known sadness. Yet she couldn't know that her greatest trials lay ahead, that this evening, when darkness fell, her life would become an opera, that Jundo was the dark figure at the end of the first act who removes the heroine to a land of lament. She sang in Italian, and then German, and then Japanese. When finally she sang in Korean, it came clear why Pyongyang had chosen her. The song was beautiful, her voice light now, singing of two lovers on a lake, and the song was not about the dear leader, or defeating the imperialists, or the pride of a North Korean factory. It was about a girl and a boy in a boat. The girl had a white Joseon ot. the boy a soulful stare. Romina sang in Korean, and her dress was graphite, and she might as well have sung of a spider that spins white thread to capture her listeners. Jundo and Gil wandered the streets of Niigata, held by that thread, pretending they weren't about to abduct her from the nearby artist's village. A line kept ringing in Jundo's mind about how in the middle of the water, the lovers decide to row no further. They walk the city in a trance, waiting for dark. Advertisements especially had an effect on Jundo. There were no ads in North Korea, and here they were on buses and posters, across video screens, immediate and imploring. Couples clasping one another, a sad child. He asked Gil what each one said, but the answers pertained to car insurance and telephone rates. Through a window, they watched Korean women cut the toenails of Japanese women. For fun, they operated a vending machine and received a bag of orange food neither would taste. Gil paused before a store that sold equipment for undersea exploration. In the window was a large bag made to stow dive gear. It was black and nylon, and the salesperson showed them how it would hold everything needed for an underwater adventure for two. They bought it. They asked a man pushing a cart if they could borrow it, and he told them at the supermarket they could get their own. Inside the store, it was almost impossible to tell what most of the boxes and packages contained. The important stuff, like radish bushels and buckets of chestnuts, were nowhere to be seen. Gil purchased a roll of heavy tape, and from a section of toys for children, a little watercolor set in a tin. Gil at least had someone to buy a souvenir for. Darkness fell. Storefronts lit suddenly with red and blue neon, and the willows were eerily illuminated from below. Car headlights flashed in his eyes. Jundo felt exposed, singled out. Where was the curfew? Why didn't the Japanese respect the dark like normal people? They stood outside a bar, time yet to kill. Inside, people were laughing and talking. Gil pulled out their yen. No sense taking any back, he said. Inside, he ordered whiskies. Two women were at the bar as well, and Gil bought their drinks. They smiled and returned to their conversation.
Did you see their teeth? Gil asked. So white and perfect, like children's teeth.
When Jundo didn't agree, Gil said,
Relax, yeah? Loosen up.
Easy for you, Jundo said. You don't have to overpower someone tonight, then get her across town. And if we don't find Officer Sa on that beach... Like that would be the worst thing, Gil said. You don't see anyone around here plotting to escape to North Korea. You don't see them coming to pluck people off our beaches. That kind of talk doesn't help.
Calm, drink up, Gil said. I'll get the singer into the bag tonight. You're not the only guy capable of beating a woman, you know? How hard can it be?
I'll handle the singer, Jundo said. You just keep it together.
I can stuff a singer in a bag, okay? Gil said. I can push a shopping cart. You just drink up. You're probably never going to see Japan again.
Gil tried to speak to the Japanese women, but they smiled and ignored him. Then he bought a drink for the bartender. She came over and talked with him while she poured it. She was thin-shouldered, but her shirt was tight and her hair was absolutely black. They drank together, and he said something to make her laugh. When she went to fill an order, Gil turned to Jundo.
If you slept with one of these girls, Gil said, you'd know it was because she wanted to, not like some military comfort girl trying to get 9 stamps a day in her quota book, or a factory gal getting married off by her housing council. Back home, pretty girls never even raise their eyes to you. You can't even have a cup of tea without her father arranging a marriage.
Pretty girls? Jundo thought.
The world thinks I'm an orphan. That's my curse, Jundo told him.
But how did a Pyongyang boy like you end up doing such shitty jobs?
Gil ordered more drinks, even though Jundo had barely touched his.
"Going to that orphanage really messed with your head," Gil said. "Just because I don't blow my nose in my hand anymore doesn't mean I'm not a country boy from Myosan. You should move on too. In Japan, you can be anyone you want to be."
They heard a motorcycle pull up, and outside the window they saw a man back it in line with a couple of other bikes. When he took the key from the ignition, he hid it under the lip of the gas tank. Gil and Jundo glanced at one another. Gil sipped his whiskey, swishing it around, then tipping his head to delicately gargle.
"You don't drink like a country boy.
You don't drink like an orphan."
"I'm not an orphan."
"Well, that's good," Gil said,
"because all the orphans in my landmine unit knew how to do was take your cigarettes, your socks, your soju. Don't you hate it when someone takes your soju? In my unit, they gobbled up everything around them, like a dog digests his pups, and for thanks, they left you the puny nuggets of their shit."
Jundo gave the smile that puts people at ease in the moment before you strike them. Gil went on,
"But you're a decent guy. You're loyal like the guy in the martyr story. You don't need to tell yourself that your father was this and your mother was that. You can be anyone you want. Reinvent yourself for a night. Forget about that drunk and the nail hole in the wall."
Jundo stood. He took a step back to get the right distance for a turnbuckle kick. He closed his eyes. He could feel the space. He could visualize the hip pivoting, the leg rising, the whip of the instep as it torqued around. Jundo had dealt with this his whole life, the ways it was impossible for people from normal families to conceive of a man in so much hurt that he couldn't acknowledge his own son, that there was nothing worse than a mother leaving her children, though it happened all the time. That take was a word people used for those who had so little to give as to be immeasurable. When Jundo opened his eyes, Gil suddenly realized what was about to happen. He fumbled his drink.
"Whoa," he said. "My mistake, okay? I'm from a big family. I don't know anything about orphans. We should go. We've got things to do."
"Okay then," Jundo said. "Let's see how you treat those pretty ladies in Pyongyang."
Behind the auditorium was the artist's village, a series of cottages ringing a central hot spring. They could see the stream of water, still steaming hot, running from the bathhouse. Mineral white, it tumbled down bald, bleached rocks toward the sea. They hid the cart, then Jundo boosted Gil over the fence. When Gil came around to open the metal gate for Jundo, Gil paused a moment and the two regarded one another through the bars before Gil lifted the latch and let Jundo in. Tiny cones of light illuminated the flagstone path to Rumina's bungalow. Above them, the dark green and white of magnolia blocked the stars. In the air was conifer and cedar, something of the ocean. Jundo tore two strips of duct tape and hung them from Gil's sleeves.
"That way," Jundo whispered. "They'll be ready to go."
Gil's eyes were thrilled and disbelieving.
"So, we're just going to storm in there?" he asked.
"I'll get the door open,"
Jundo said.
"Then you get that tape on her mouth."
Jundo pried a large flagstone from the path and carried it to the door. He placed it against the knob, and when he threw his hip into it, the door popped. Gil ran toward a woman, sitting up in bed, illuminated only by a television. Jundo watched from the doorway as Gil got the tape across her mouth, but then in the sheets and the softness of the bed, the tide seemed to turn. He lost a clump of hair. Then she got his collar, which she used to off-balance him. Finally, he found her neck, and they went to the floor, where he worked his weight onto her, the pain making her feet curl. Jundo stared long at those toes. The nails had been painted bright red. At first, Jundo had been thinking, grab her here, pressure her there. But then a sick feeling rose in him. As the two rolled, Jundo could see that she had wet herself, and the rawness of it, the brutality of what was happening, was newly clear to him. Gil was bringing her into submission, taping her wrists and ankles, and she was kneeling now, him laying out the bag and unzipping it. When he spread the opening for her, her eyes, wide and wet, failed, and her posture went woozy. Jundo pulled off his glasses, and things were better with the blur. Outside, he breathed deeply. He could hear Gil struggling to fold her up so she would fit in the bag. The stars over the ocean, fuzzy now, made him remember how free he'd felt on that first night crossing of the Sea of Japan, how at home he was on a fishing vessel. Back inside, he saw Gil had zipped the bag so that only Rumina's face showed, her nostrils flaring for oxygen. Gil stood over her, exhausted but smiling. He pressed the fabric of his pants against his groin so she could see the outline of his erection. When her eyes went wide, he pulled the zipper shut. Quickly, they went through her possessions. Gil pocketed yen and a necklace of red and white stones. Jundo didn't know what to grab. On a table were medicine bottles, cosmetics, a stack of family photos. When his eyes landed on the graphite dress, he pulled it from its hanger.
"What the fuck are you doing?" Gil asked.
"I don't know," Jundo told him. The cart, overburdened, made loud clacking sounds at every crease in the sidewalk. They didn't speak. Gil was scratched and his shirt was torn. It looked like he was wearing makeup that had smeared. A clear yellow fluid had risen through the scab where his hair was missing. When the cement sloped at the curbs, the wheels had a tendency to spin funny and spill the cart, the load dumping to the pavement. Bundles of cardboard lined the streets. Dishwashers hosed down kitchen mats in the gutters. A bright, empty bus whooshed past. Near the park, a man walked a large white dog that stopped and eyed them. The bag would squirm a while, then go still. At a corner, Gil told Jundo to turn left, and there, down a steep hill and across a parking lot, was the beach.
"I'm going to watch our backs," Gil said.
The cart wanted free. Jundo doubled his grip on the handle.
"Okay," he answered.
From behind, Gil said,
"I was out of line back there with that orphan talk. I don't know what it's like to have parents who are dead or who gave up. I was wrong. I see that now."
"No harm done," Jundo said. "I'm not an orphan." From behind, Gil said,
"So tell me about the last time you saw your father."
The cart kept trying to break loose. Each time, Jundo had to lean back and skid his feet. Well, there wasn't a going-away party or anything. The cart lurched forward and dragged Jundo a couple of meters before he got his traction back. "I'd been there longer than anyone. I was never getting adopted. My father wasn't going to let anyone take his only son. Anyway, he came to me that night. We'd burned our bunks, so I was on the floor.
Gil, help me here."
Suddenly, the cart was racing. Jundo tumbled as it came free of his grip and barreled downhill alone.
"Gil!"
he yelled, watching it go. The cart got speed wobbles as it crossed the parking lot, and striking the far curb, the cart hopped high into the air, pitching the black bag out into the dark sand. He turned, but Gil was nowhere to be seen. Jundo ran out onto the sand, passing the bag in the odd way it had settled. Down at the waterline, he scanned the waves for Officer Saw, but there was nothing. He checked his pockets. He had no map, no watch, no light. Hands on knees, he couldn't catch his breath. Past him, billowing down the beach, came the graphite dress, filling and emptying in the wind, tumbling along the sand until it was taken by the night. He found the bag, rolled it over. He unzipped it some, heat pouring out. He pulled the tape from her face, which was abraded with nylon burns. She spoke to him in Japanese.
"I don't understand," he said.
In Korean, she said,
"Thank God you rescued me."
He studied her face, how raw and puffy it was.
"Some psychopath stuck me in here," she said. "Thank God you came along. I thought I was dead, and then you came to set me free."
Jun-do looked again for any sign of Gil, but he knew there wouldn't be.
"Thanks for getting me out of here," she said. "Really, thanks for setting me free."
Jun-do tested the strip of tape with his fingers, but it had lost much of its stickiness. A lock of her hair was fixed to the tape. He let it go in the wind.
"My God,"
she said.
"You're one of them."
Sand blew into the bag, into her eyes.
"Believe me," he said. "I know what you're going through."
"You don't have to be a bad guy," she said. "There's goodness in you. I can see it. Let me go, and I'll sing for you. You won't believe how I can sing."
"Your song has been troubling me," he said. "The one about the boy who chooses to quit rowing in the middle of the lake."
"That was only an aria," she said. "From a whole opera, one filled with subplots and reversals and betrayals."
Jun-do leaned close now. "Does the boy stop because he has rescued the girl, and on the far shore he will have to give her to his superiors? Or has the boy stolen the girl and therefore knows that punishment awaits?"
"It's a love story," she said.
"I understand that," he said. "But what is the answer? Could it be that he knows he's marked for a labor camp?"
She searched his face as if he knew the answer. "How does it end?" he asked. "What happens to them?"
"Let me out and I'll tell you," she said. "Open this bag and I'll sing you the ending."
Jun-do took the zipper and closed it. He spoke to the black nylon where her face had been.
"Keep your eyes open," he said. "I know there's nothing to see, but whatever happens, don't shut them. Darkness and close quarters, they're not your enemy."
He dragged the bag to the waterline. The ocean, frothy cold, washed over his shoes as he scanned the waves for Officer Saw. When a wave reached high upon the sand and licked the bag, she screamed inside, and he had never heard such a shriek. From far up the beach, a light flashed at him. Officer Saw had heard her. He brought the black inflatable around, and Jun-do dragged the bag into the surf. Using the straps, the two of them rolled it into the boat.
"Where's Gil?"
he asked.
"Gil's gone," Jun-do said. "He was right beside me, and then he wasn't."
They were knee-deep in waves, steadying the boat. The lights of the city were reflected in Officer Saw's eyes.
"You know what happened to the other mission officers?" he asked. "There were four of us. Now there's only me. The others are in Prison 9. Have you heard of that place, Tunnel Man? The whole prison's underground. It's a mine. And when you go in, you never see the sun again. Look, scaring me isn't going to change anything. I don't know where he is."
Officer Saw went on.
"There's an iron gate at the mine head. And once you pass that, that's it. There are no guards inside, no doctors, no cafeteria, no toilets. You just dig in the dark. And when you get some ore, you drag it to the surface to trade to the bars for food and candles and pickaxes. Even the bodies don't come out." "He could be anywhere," Jun-do said. "He speaks Japanese."
From the bag came Rumina's voice.
"I can help you,"
she said.
"I know Niigata like the lines on my palm. Let me out, and I swear I'll find him."
They ignored her.
"Who is this guy?" Jun-do asked. "The spoiled kid of some minister," Officer Saw said. "That's what they tell me. His dad sent him here to toughen him up. You know, the hero's son, always the meekest."
Jun-do turned and considered the lights of Niigata. Officer Saw put his hand on Jun-do's shoulder.
"You're soldierly," he said. "When it comes time to dispense, you dispense.
He removed the bag's nylon shoulder strap and made a slip loop at one end.
Gil's got a noose around our fucking necks. Now it's his turn.
Jundo walked the warehouse district with a strange calm. The moon, such as it was, reflected the same in every puddle, and when a bus stopped for him, the driver took one look and asked for no fare. The bus was empty except for two old Korean men in back. They still wore their white paper short order hats. Jundo spoke to them, but they shook their heads. Jundo needed the motorcycle to stand a chance of finding Gil in this city. But if Gil had any brain at all, he and the bike were long gone. When Jundo finally rounded the corner to the whiskey bar, the black motorcycle gleamed at the curb. He threw his leg over the seat, touched the handlebars. But when he felt under the lip of the tank, there was no key. He turned to the bar's front windows, and there through the glass was Gil, laughing with the bartender. Jundo took a seat beside Gil, who was intent on a watercolor in progress. He had the paint set open, and he dipped the brush in a shot glass of water tinctured purple-green. It was a landscape, with bamboo patches and paths cutting through a field of stones. Gil looked up at Jundo, then wet his brush, swirling it in yellow to highlight the bamboo stalks. Jundo said to him, "You're so fucking stupid."
"You're the stupid one," Gil said. "You got the singer. Who would come back for me?"
"I would," Jundo told him. "Let's have the key." The motorcycle key was sitting on the bar, and Gil slid it to him.
Gil twirled his finger in the air to signal another round. The bartender came over. She was wearing Romina's necklace. Gil spoke to her, then peeled off half the yen and gave it to Jundo.
"I told her, this round's on you," Gil said.
The bartender poured three glasses of whiskey, then said something that made Gil laugh. Jundo asked, "What did she say?"
"She said you look very strong, but too bad you're a pussy man."
Jundo looked at Gil. Gil shrugged.
"I maybe told her that you and I got in a fight over a girl. I said that I was winning until you pulled out my hair."
Jundo said, "You can still get out of this. We won't say anything, I swear. We'll just go back, and it'll be like you never ran."
"Does it look like I'm running?"
Gil asked.
"Besides, I can't leave my girlfriend."
Gil handed her the watercolor, and she tacked it on the wall to dry, next to another one of her, looking radiant in the red and white necklace. Squinting from a distance, Jundo suddenly understood that Gil had painted not a landscape, but a lush, pastoral landmine map.
"So you were in the minefields," he said.
"My mother sent me to the Mansudae to study painting," Gil said. "But father decided the minefields would make a man of me, so he pulled some strings."
Gil had to laugh at the idea of pulling a string to get posted on a suicide detail.
"I found a way to make the maps rather than do the mapping."
As he spoke, he worked quickly on another watercolor, a woman, mouth wide, lit from below so her eye sockets were darkened. Right away, it had the likeness of Romina, though you couldn't tell whether she was singing with great intensity or screaming for her life.
"Tell her you'll have one last drink,"
Jundo said, and passed her all the yen.
"I'm really sorry about all this," Gil said. "I really am. But I'm not going anywhere. Consider the opera singer a gift and send my regrets."
"Was it your father who wanted the singer? Is that why we're here?"
Gil ignored him. He started painting a portrait of him and Jundo together, each giving the thumbs up sign. They wore garish, forced smiles, and Jundo didn't want him to finish.
"Let's go," Jundo said. "You don't want to be late for karaoke night at the Yanggakdo or whatever you elites do for fun."
Gil didn't move. He was emphasizing Jundo's muscles, making them oversized, like an ape's.
"It's true," Gil said. "I've tasted beef and ostrich.
I've seen Titanic and I've been on the internet 10 different times. And yeah, there's karaoke. Every week there's an empty table where a family used to sit, but now they're gone. No mention of them. And the songs they used to sing are missing from the machine.
I promise you, Jundo said. Come back, and no one will ever know.
The question isn't whether or not I'll come with you, Gil said. It's why you're not coming with me.
If Jundo wanted to defect, he could have done it a dozen times. At the end of a tunnel, it was as easy as climbing the ladder and triggering a spring-loaded door.
In this whole stupid country, Jundo said, the only thing that made sense to me were the Korean ladies on their knees cleaning the feet of the Japanese.
I could take you to the South Korean embassy tomorrow. It's just a train ride. In 6 weeks, you'd be in Seoul. You'd be very useful to them, a real prize.
Your mother, your father, Jundo said. They'll get sent to the camps.
Whether you're a good karaoke singer or bad, eventually your number comes up. It's only a matter of time.
What about Officer Saw? Will some fancy whiskey make you forget him digging in the dark of Prison 9?
He's the reason to leave, Gil said. So you don't become him.
Well, he sends his regards, Jundo said, and dropped the loop of nylon over Gil's head, pulling the slack so the strap was snug around his neck. Gil downed his whiskey.
I'm just a person, he said. I'm just a nobody who wants out.
The bartender saw the leash. Covering her mouth, she said, "Homojanai."
I guess I don't need to translate that, Gil said.
Jundo gave the leash a tug and they both stood. Gil closed his watercolor tin, then bowed to the bartender.
"주선진니 주 살라렐루야,"
he said to her. With her phone, she took a picture of the two of them, then poured herself a drink. She lifted it in Gil's honor before drinking.
"Fucking Japanese," Gil said. "You've got to love them. I said I was being kidnapped to North Korea, and look at her."
"Take a good long look," Jundo said, and lifted the motorcycle key from the bar. Past the shore break, they motored into swells sharpened by the wind. The black inflatable lifted, then dropped flat in the troughs. Everyone held the lifeline to steady themselves. Rumina sat in the nose, fresh tape around her hands. Officer Saw had draped his jacket around her. Except for that, her body was bare and blue with cold. Jundo and Gil sat on opposite sides of the raft, but Gil wouldn't look at him. When they reached open water, Officer Saw backed off the engine enough that Jundo could be heard.
"I gave Gil my word," he told Officer Saw. "I said we'd forget how he tried to run."
Rumina sat with the wind at her back, hair turbulent in her face.
"Put him in the bag," she said.
Officer Saw had a grand laugh at that.
"The opera lady's right," he said. "You caught a defector, my boy. He had a fucking gun to our heads, but he couldn't outsmart us. Start thinking of your reward," he said. "Start savoring it."
The idea of a reward, of finding his mother and delivering her from her fate in Pyongyang, now made him sick. In the tunnels, they would sometimes wander into a curtain of gas. You couldn't detect it. A headache would spike, and you'd see the darkness throb red. He felt that now with Rumina glaring at him. He suddenly wondered if she didn't mean him, that Jundo should go in the bag. But he wasn't the one who beat her or folded her up. It wasn't his father who'd ordered her kidnapping. And what choice did he have about anything? He couldn't help that he was from a town lacking in electricity and heat and fuel, where the factories were frozen in rust, where able-bodied men were either in labor camps or were listless with hunger. It wasn't his fault that all the boys in his care were numb with abandonment and hopeless at the prospect of being recruited as prison guards or conscripted into suicide squads. The lead was still around Gil's neck. Out of pure joy, Officer Saw leaned over and yanked it hard, just to feel it cinch.
I'd roll you over the side, he said, but I'd miss what they're going to do to you.
Gil winced from the pain.
Jando knows how to do it now, he said. He'll replace you, and they'll send you to a camp so you never talk about this business.
You don't know anything,
Officer Saw said.
You're soft and weak. I fucking invented this game. I kidnapped Kim Jong-il's personal sushi chef. I plucked the dear leader's own doctor out of an Osaka hospital in broad daylight with these hands.
You don't know how Pyongyang works, Gil said. Once the other ministers see her, they'll all want their own opera singers.
A cold white spray slapped them. It made Romina inhale sharply, as if every little thing was trying to take her life. She turned to Jun-do, glaring again. She was about to say something, he could tell. A word was forming on her lips. He unfolded his glasses, put them on. Now he could see the bruising on her throat, the way her hands were fat and purple below the tape on her wrists. He saw a wedding ring, a birth surgery scar. She wouldn't stop glaring at him. Her eyes. They could see the decisions he'd made. They could tell it was Jun-do who picked which orphans ate first and which were left with watery spoonfuls. They recognized that it was he who assigned the bunks next to the stove and the ones in the hall where Blackfinger lurked. He'd picked the boys who got blinded by the arc furnace. He'd chosen the boys who were at the chemical plant when it made the sky go yellow. He'd sent Hashin, the boy who wouldn't speak, who wouldn't say no, to clean the vats at the paint factory. It was Jun-do who put the gaff in Bo-sung's hands.
What choice did I have?
Jun-do asked her. He really needed to know, just as he had to know what happened to the boy and the girl at the end of the aria. She raised her foot and showed Jun-do her toenails, the red paint vibrant against the platinum dark. She spoke a word, then drove her foot into his face. The blood, it was dark. It trickled down his shirt, last worn by the man they'd plucked from the beach. Her big toenail had cut along his gums, but it was okay. He felt better. He knew the word now, the word that had been upon her lips. He didn't need to speak Japanese to understand the word, die. It was the ending to the opera, too. He was sure of it. That's what happened to the boy and the girl on the boat. It wasn't a sad story, really. It was one of love. The boy and the girl, at least, knew each other's fates. And they'd never be alone. There were many kidnappings to come, years of them, in fact. There was the old woman they came upon in a tidal pool on Nishino Island. Her pants were rolled up and she peered into a camera mounted on three wooden legs. Her hair was gray and wild, and she went without protest in exchange for Jun-do's portrait. There was the Japanese climatologist they discovered on an iceberg in the Sugaru Strait. They plucked his scientific equipment and red kayak, too. There was a rice farmer, a jetty engineer, and a woman who said she'd come to the beach to drown herself. Then the kidnappings ended, as suddenly as they'd begun. Jun-do was assigned to language school to spend a year learning English. He asked the control officer in Gyeongsong if the new post was a reward for stopping a minister's son from defecting. The officer took Jun-do's old military uniform, his liquor ration card, and coupon book for prostitutes. When the officer saw the book was nearly full, he smiled.
Sure, he said.
Ma Jun-ni in the Onjin Mountains was colder than Chongjin had ever been. Jun-do was grateful for the blue headphones he wore all day, as they drowned out the endless tank exercises of the 9th Mechanized, which was stationed there. The school officials had no interest in teaching Jun-do to speak English. He simply had to transcribe it, learning vocabulary and grammar over the headphones, and key by clacking key, parroting it back on his manual typewriter.
I would like to purchase a puppy,
the woman's voice would say over the headphones, and this Jun-do would tap out. At least near the end, the school got a human teacher, a rather sad man, prone to depression that Pyongyang had acquired from Africa.
The man spoke no Korean, and he spent the classes asking the students grand, unanswerable questions, which greatly increased their command of the interrogative mode. For 4 seasons, Jundo managed to avoid poisonous snakes, self-criticism sessions, and tetanus, which struck soldiers nearly every week. It would start innocently enough. A barbed wire puncture, a cut from the rim of a ration tin. But soon came fevers, tremors, and finally a coiling of the musculature that left the body too twisted and rigid for a casket. Jundo's reward for these achievements was a listening post in the East Sea, aboard the fishing vessel Junma. His quarters were down in the Junma's aft hold, a steel room big enough for a table, a chair, a typewriter, and a stack of receivers that had been pilfered from downed American planes in the war. The hold was lit only by the green glow of the listening equipment, which was reflected in the sheen of fish water that seeped under the bulkheads and constantly slicked the floor. Even after 3 months aboard the ship, Jundo couldn't stop visualizing what was on the other side of those metal walls. Chambers of tightly packed fish sucking their last breath in the refrigerated dark. They'd been in international waters for several days now, their North Korean flag lowered so as not to invite trouble. First, they chased deep-running mackerel, and then schools of jittery bonito that surfaced in brief patches of sun. Now they were after sharks. All night, the Junma had long-lined for them at the edge of the trench, and at daybreak, Jundo could hear above him the grinding of the winch and the slapping of sharks as they cleared the water and struck the hull. From sunset to sunrise, Jundo monitored the usual transmissions. Fishing captains mostly, the ferry from Uichi to Vladivostok, even the nightly check-in of 2 American women rowing around the world. One rowed all night, the other all day, ruining the crew's theory that they'd made their way to the East Sea for the purpose of having girl sex. Hidden inside the Junma's rigging and booms was a strong array antenna, and above the helm was a directional antenna that could turn 360 degrees. The U.S. and Japan and South Korea all encrypted their military transmissions, which sounded only like squeals and bleats. But how much squeal and where and when seemed really important to Pyongyang. As long as he documented that, he could listen to whatever he liked. It was clear that the crew didn't like having him aboard. He had an orphan's name, and all night he clacked away on his typewriter down there in the dark. It was as if having a person aboard whose job it was to perceive and record threats made the crew, young men from the port of Kinje, sniff the air for danger as well. And then there was the captain. He had reason to be wary. And each time Jundo made him change course to track down an unusual signal, it was all he could do to contain his anger at the ill luck of having a listening officer posted to his fishing ship. Only when Jundo started relating to the crew the updates of the 2 American girls rowing around the world did they begin to warm to him. When Jundo had filled out his daily requisition of military soundings, he roamed the spectrum. The lepers sent out broadcasts, as did the blind, and the families of inmates imprisoned in Manila, who broadcast news into the prisons. All day the families would line up to speak of report cards, baby teeth, and new job prospects. There was Dr. Rendezvous, a Brit who broadcast his erotic dreams every day, along with the coordinates of where his sailboat would be anchored next. There was a station in Okinawa that broadcast portraits of families that U.S. servicemen refused to claim. Once a day, the Chinese broadcast prisoner confessions, and it didn't matter that the confessions were forced, false, and in a language he didn't understand. Jundo could barely make it through them. And then came that girl who rode in the dark. Each night she paused to relay her coordinates, how her body was performing, and the atmospheric conditions. Often she noted things. The outlines of birds migrating at night. A whale shark seining for krill off her bow. She had, she said, a growing ability to dream while she rowed. What was it about English speakers that allowed them to talk into transmitters as if the sky were a diary? If Koreans spoke this way, maybe they'd make more sense to Jundo.
Maybe he'd understand why some people accepted their fates while others didn't. He might know why people sometimes scoured all the orphanages looking for one particular child, when any child would do, when there were perfectly good children everywhere. He'd know why all the fishermen on the Junma had their wives' portraits tattooed on their chests, while he was a man who wore headphones in the dark of a fishhold on a boat that was 27 days at sea a month. Not that he envied those who rowed in the daylight. The light, the sky, the water, they were all things you looked through during the day. At night, they were things you looked into. You looked into the stars. You looked into dark rollers and the surprising platinum flash of their caps. No one ever stared at the tip of a cigarette in the daylight hours, and with the sun in the sky, who would ever post a watch? At night on the Junma, there was acuity, quietude, pause. There was a look in the crew members' eyes that was both far away and inward. Presumably, there was another English linguist out there, on a similar fishing boat, pointlessly listening to broadcasts from sunrise to sunset. It was certainly another lowly transcriber like himself. He'd heard that the language school where they taught you to speak English was in Pyongyang and was filled with yangbans, kids of the elite who were in the military as a prerequisite to the party and then a life as a diplomat. Jundo could just imagine their patriotic names and fancy Chinese clothes as they spent their days in the capital practicing dialogues about ordering coffee and buying overseas medicines. Above, another shark flopped onto the deck, and Jundo decided to call it a night. As he was turning off his instruments, he heard the ghost broadcast. Once a week or so, an English transmission came through that was powerful and brief, just a couple of minutes before it was gone. Tonight, the speakers had American and Russian accents, and as usual, the broadcast was from the middle of a conversation. The two spoke about her trajectory and a docking maneuver and fuel. Last week, there'd been a Japanese speaker with them. Jundo manned the crank that slowly turned the directional antenna, but no matter where he aimed it, the signal strength was the same, which was impossible. How could a signal come from everywhere? Just like that, the broadcast seemed to end. But Jundo grabbed his UHF receiver and a handheld parabolic and headed above decks. The ship was an old Soviet steel-hulled vessel made for cold water, and its sharp, tall bow made it plunge deep into waves and leap the troughs. He held the rail and pointed the dish into the morning haze, sweeping the horizon. He picked up some chatter from container vessel pilots, and toward Japan, he got all the craft advisories cross-cut with a VHF Christian broadcast. There was blood on the deck, and Jundo's military boots left drunk-looking tracks all the way to the stern, where the only transmissions were the squawks and barks of U.S. naval encryption. He did a quick sweep of the sky, dialing in a Taiwan Air pilot who lamented the approach of DPRK airspace. But there was nothing. The signal was gone.
"Anything I should know about?" the captain asked.
"Steady as she goes," Jundo told the captain. The captain nodded toward the directional antenna atop the helm, which was made to look like a loudspeaker.
"That one's a little more subtle," he said.
There was an agreement that Jundo wouldn't do anything foolish, like bringing spying equipment on deck. The captain was older. He'd been a heavy man, but he'd done some time aboard a Russian penal vessel, and that had leaned him so that now his skin hung loose. You could tell he'd once been an intense captain, giving clear-eyed commands, even if they were to fish in waters contested by Russia. And you could tell he'd been an intense prisoner, laboring carefully and without complaint under intense scrutiny. And now, it seemed, he was both. The captain lit a cigarette, offered one to Jundo, then returned to tallying sharks, using a hand counter to click off each one the machinist winched aboard. The sharks had been hanging from lead lines in open water,
so they were in a low-oxygen stupor when they breached the water and slammed against the hull before being boomed up. On deck, they moved slowly, nosing around like blind puppies, their mouths opening and closing as if there were something they were trying to say. The job of the second mate, because he was young and new to the ship, was to retrieve the hooks, while the first mate, in 7 quick cuts, dorsal to anal, took the fins and then rolled the shark back into the water, where, unable to maneuver, it could race nowhere but down, disappearing into the blackness, leaving only a thin contrail of blood behind. Jundo leaned over the side and watched one descend, following it down with his parabolic. The water crossing the shark's gills would revive its mind and perceptions. They were above the trench now, almost 4 kilometers deep, perhaps a half hour of freefall, and through his headphones, the background hiss of the abyss sounded more like the creeping, spooky crackle of pressure death. There was nothing to hear down there. All the subs communicated with ultra-low frequency bursts. Still, he pointed his parabolic toward the waves and slowly panned from bow to stern. The ghost broadcast had to come from somewhere. How could it seem to come from every direction if it didn't come from below? He could feel the eyes of the crew.
"You find something down there?"
the machinist asked.
"Actually," Jundo said, "I lost something."
Come first light, Jundo slept, while the crew, pilot, machinist, first mate, second mate, and captain alike, spent the day crating the shark fins in layers of salt and ice. The Chinese paid in hard currency, and they were very particular about their fins. Jundo woke before dinner, which was breakfast time for him. He had reports to type before darkness fell. There had been a fire on the Junma which took the galley, the head, and half of the bunks, leaving only the tin plates, a black mirror, and a toilet that had cracked in two from the heat. But the stove still worked, and it was summer, so everyone sat on the hatches to eat, where it was possible for the men to view a rare sunset. On the horizon was a carrier group from the American fleet, ships so large they didn't look as if they could move, let alone float. It looked like an island chain, so fixed and ancient as to have its own people and language and gods. On the long line, they'd caught a grouper, whose cheeks they ate raw on the spot, and a turtle, unusual to hook. The turtle would take a day to stew, but the fish they baked whole and pulled off the bone with their fingers. A squid had also snagged on the line, but the captain wouldn't abide them on board. He had lectured them many times on the squid. He considered the octopus the most intelligent animal in the ocean, the squid the most savage. They took off their shirts and smoked, even as the sun fell. The Junma was pilotless, cantering in the waves, buoys rolling loose on the deck, and even the cables and booms glowed orange in the oven-colored light. The life of a fisherman was good. There were no endless factory quotas to fill, and on a ship there was no loudspeaker blaring government reports all day. There was food. And even though they were leery about having a listening officer on board, it meant that the Junma got all the fuel coupons it needed, and if Jundo directed the ship in a way that lowered the catch, everyone got extra ration cards.
"So, third mate," the pilot said, "how are our girls?"
That's what they call Jundo sometimes, the third mate, as a joke. "They're nearing Hokkaido," Jundo told them. "At least they were last night. They're rowing 30 kilometers a day."
"Are they still naked?" the machinist asked.
"Only the girl who rows in the dark," said Jundo.
"To row around the world," the second mate said. "Only a sexy woman would do that. It's so pointless and arrogant. Only sexy Americans would think the world was something to defeat."
The second mate couldn't have been more than 20. On his chest, the tattoo of his wife was new, and it was clear she was a beauty.
"Who said they were sexy?"
Jundo asked, though he pictured them that way too.
"I know this," the second mate said. "A sexy girl thinks she can do anything. Trust me, I deal with it every day.
If your wife is so hot, the machinist asked, how come they didn't sweep her up to be a hostess in Pyongyang?
It's easy, the second mate said. Her father didn't want her ending up as a barmaid or a whore in Pyongyang. So he pulled some strings and got her assigned to the fish factory. A beautiful girl like that, and along comes me.
I'll believe it when I see it, the first mate said. There's a reason she doesn't come to see you off.
Give it time, the second mate said. She's still coping.
I'll show her the light.
Hokkaido, the pilot said. The ice up there is worse in the summer. The shelves break up, currents chum it. It's the ice you don't see. That's what gets you.
The captain spoke. Shirtless, you could see all his Russian tattoos. They looked heavy in the sideways light, as if they were what had pulled his skin loose.
The winter's up there, he said. Everything freezes. The piss in your prick and the fish gore in your beard. You try to set a knife down and you can't let go of it. Once, we were on the cutting floor when the ship hit a growler. It shook the whole boat, knocked us down into the guts. From the floor, we watched that ice roll down the side of the ship, knuckling big dents in the hull.
Jundo looked at the captain's chest. The tattoo of his wife was blurred and faded to a watercolor. When the captain's ship didn't return one day, his wife had been given a replacement husband, and now the captain was alone. Plus, they'd added the years he was in prison to his service debt to the state, so there'd be no retirement now.
The cold can squeeze a ship, the captain suddenly said. Contract the whole thing, the metal door frames, the locks, trapping you down in the waste tanks, and nobody, nobody's coming with buckets of hot water to get you out.
The captain didn't throw a look or anything, but Jundo wondered if the prison talk was aimed at him, for bringing his listening equipment on deck, for raising the specter that it could all happen again.